Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Duke.
The power of Christ compiles you.
I like the power of Christ compiles you.
Sorry. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. We're talking compilations. That was where that came from. Don, how you doing, my friend? You ready to get compiled?
Remember the songs that made you sing along?
Sure do.
The hits that turned moments into memories?
I'll never forget.
Now, Time Life is proud to present the Album Nerds.
For those that remember those infomercials on TV where they'd have these compilations of songs, that's kind of what we're doing today, a little bit. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and sometimes we like to blur the lines. We have a great show for you today. We'll be discussing two compilation albums, which is a little outside of our norm.
Yes.
Is it an album? Is it really cohesive? All that stuff comes into play. Don, of course, will be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging, new releases, etc. And then we will spin the wheel of musical discovery to learn what kind of albums we'll be discovering next time. But this week, it's all about the compilations.
That's what I'm talking about!
Various artist compilations bring together recordings by multiple performers, most often organized around a common theme, genre, or time period. These albums can be a window into the diversity of a label's roster or a snapshot of musical trends. Whether designed for promotion, celebration, or discovery, such compilations invite listeners to explore new sounds and artists side by side, highlighting both individual creativity and collective musical movements.
We potentially in the future could have a topic that's similar, but compilations as in like greatest hits or rarities, that kind of thing. But this time it's specifically those various artists. There are several to consider. One of the biggest problems is in the streaming age, a lot of these albums are not available because record label, you know, who owns the rights and all that kind of stuff. So many of these had partial listings of songs. So that made it a little more challenging. Don, what else did you consider?
Well, I thought about one from 1991 that MTV put out, basically promoting 120 minutes. So it was a two CD set that included like Chili Peppers and Stone Roses and groups like that. And then there's another one I knew in high school called Gothic Rock.
And shocking that you would have that one.
Yeah, so I had, you know, Bauhaus and Alien, cool. Sex Fiend and stuff like that.
Sure.
But yeah, I couldn't find all of those songs on the streaming services.
I thought one that might be fun to talk about is We Are the World from 1985, the USA for Africa thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because on it, besides that song, were unreleased tracks by like Bruce Springsteen and Prince and Huey Lewis in the News. But again, the only song available on streaming is the title track. Encomnium, a tribute to Led Zeppelin from 95, had Stone Temple Pilots, Sheryl Crow, Duran Duran, Hootie and the Blowfish. It was available, but the covers were mostly kind of weak. They didn't take many chances in terms of interpretations.
I got a woman, she won't be true.
Yeah. I got a woman, she don't call the term. Yeah. And Sweet Relief, a benefit for Victoria Williams, was very compelling from 1993. She was a singer-songwriter, was diagnosed with MS, and then all these artists came together to try and raise money for her treatments. Pearl Jam, Lou Reed, Soul Asylum, Buffalo Tom.
Oh, yeah. Is that where Crazy Mary came from?
Yeah. But the final track of the album is the only thing missing on the streaming, and I couldn't, in good conscience, choose an album that our listeners couldn't go easily listen to all the way through. So yeah, those were some of those that I considered, but the picks are in. Our notes have been compiled. So why don't we get to our cha-cha-cha choices?
You choose me?
Right. My compilation album comes from 1968. It was called This Is Soul. It's a compilation of songs from Atlantic and Stax Records, which were, you know, major, you know, soul labels at the time. And it was released in the UK initially to try to promote soul music there, which really hadn't gotten a foothold yet. So supposedly this compilation, you know, did a lot to introduce soul music to the Brits.
Cool.
Features two songs from Wilson Pickett, two from Percy Sledge. It's got Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, Sam and Dave. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got some big songs and big artists from the era. Let's start off with Mustang Sally by Wilson Pickett.
Yeah, I wish there was more music, like current music, that sounded like this.
Yeah,
certain swagger is missing now.
So this song was originally written and recorded by Sir Mac Rice in 1965, and it was called Mustang Mama.
Ah. Now, was this guy knighted, or is that just this?
That's like a good question. So the song was inspired by, you know, of course, the Ford Mustang sports car. Apparently, Aretha Franklin, who played piano on Rice's demo, she suggested a title change to Mustang Sally. And the song uses a children's game song called Little Sally Walker. That's not one that I know. Is that maybe one you do with Double Dutch or something?
I don't know, man. It seems like you could have done the research.
So Pickett's version was recorded in Muscle Shoals studio in Alabama. Features the legendary Muscle Shoals rhythm section. You know, they got the Swampers.
Now, what's with the Muscle Shoals? Is that because of the disgusting edible clam type thing, mussels, or is that
that was always my assumption, but
okay.
But I don't know. See, again, a lack of research on my part.
There you go.
Yeah, well, you asked tough questions.
I'm a thinker, not a stinker.
So if you want to find the album that the song originally appeared on, it was on an album called The Wicked Picket from 1966.
Oh, great title.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a great way to start off a soul compilation. You know, I mean, this is a, you know, an epic song, and, you know, Wilson Pickett is a, you know, very distinct voice, very expressive delivery.
It's got that whole Testify vibe to it, like half preacher, half party host. And of course, you know, there's that Slow That Mustang Down, which is a not so subtle sexual metaphor, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, the car songs always being about sex when it comes to it, you know, of that era. So, yeah, I mean, this is a bar band staple and will never not exist.
All right. Well, let's hear a cut from the other artist who's got two songs on the album. Here's When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge.
Yeah, unfortunately, the only thing I think when I hear this song is Michael Bolton.
Oh, geez.
His heart-wrenching, throat-wrenching rendition. When a man
loves a woman, Michael Bolton is a fantastic lover.
Strangely, the first thing I think of is a promo for like the first episode of The Wonder Years.
Oh, God.
I think it debuted like right after the Super Bowl. And so like during the Super Bowl, they were promoting the crap out of it. And When a Man Loves a Woman was the featured song.
I loved The Wonder Years, that TV show about a kid growing up in the 60s. So I had a TV time limit. And that show did not count against it because my parents liked it so much. Because it was about their generation, you know, so.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I became familiar with so many songs of that era because of that show. So When a Man Loves a Woman was credited to Calvin Lewis and Andrew Wright, who were in Sledge's group. They were known as the Esquires. There is some debate here. I guess Sledge claims that he wrote the song, but just gave those guys credit, you know, to throw them a bone. So, I mean, who knows? But again, you know, it's the Muscle Shoals rhythm section produced by Rick Hall. I mean, Sledge is just another great voice. And that's really what this album is about, right? It's just distinct, powerful voices.
Yeah. Well, and because especially when it's basically the same backing band for the most part. Mm-hmm. The individual deliveries and personalities through these songs that probably to some degree were like interchangeable, like who's going to do this one? Who's mm-hmm. this fit for best?
Yeah, just like Motown.
Yeah, yeah, just like Motown. And it works really well. Just throwing in, I love the album cover where it's like puzzle pieces and then someone singing their heart out. It does capture the sound of the record really well. And back in those days, that meant a lot. In a record store flipping through stuff and you see something compelling.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very important part of this compilation. If they were trying to communicate what this music's all about, I think that cover is important.
Yeah. And I think even though maybe the record buying public wasn't that aware of American Soul, I think like your British invasion bands certainly sure. were, you know, so some of this was at the, you know, at the root of, you know, a lot of, you know, what those artists were doing. So was there a song you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, of course I had one that stuck out, probably the most obvious artist on here to want to listen to, Aretha Franklin. Only one of two females featured on this album. And, you know, when some people got two songs, you'd think they could have spread the wealth a little bit more. But it's called I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You.
Kiss me once again.
Seems like she was workshopping her entire, you know, like everything she's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like the blueprint in terms of what she became as the Queen of Soul. Was that what people called her?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. It was also a shoe store. Just kidding.
Oh, there you go. This was Aretha's. If it isn't, it should be. This is Aretha's breakthrough single, recorded at the Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals. This was her first Atlantic release after years of underuse at Columbia as more of a jazz singer. Swampy groove, that electric piano from Spooner Oldham. It's a plea of total devotion, Franklin confessing she loves a man despite his faults, even when others tell her she shouldn't. And I think it probably struck a chord, especially in an era where women were asked to keep quiet and, you know, care for their men and fulfill their roles. And I think this is an important step in starting to recognize that not everything's perfect and it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, she's really incredible. And it's amazing, even on a compilation that has Wilson Pickett and Percy Sledge, that, like, I mean, she just really stands out as an incredible talent. And, I mean, this isn't even, you know, one of her best songs. And it just, you know, it, like, melts the record or something. She's really incredible.
Critics point to it as the exact moment that she found her true artistic identity and, it, you know, blending that gospel intensity with secular themes. I think a lot of probably America, but then certainly Britain, was unfamiliar with what gospel, when it is sung from the heart, what it feels like, that it rattles your ribs, you know, and I think she captured that well.
Yeah, and I didn't realize, you know, she plays piano on most of her tracks, including this one.
Cool.
All right, well, let's move to the closing song. And again, it's Wilson Pickett. So he bookends this this compilation, Land of a Thousand Dances.
Na 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 na
Land of a Thousand Dances?
Yeah. I had no clue. When I saw that title, I'm like, never heard of that. And it started playing.
I knew the name of the song, and it's for a stupid reason. The WWF, as it was called at the time, they came out with the wrestling album that featured wrestlers singing. And like the big single was this song, and it was, you know, each wrestler sang a different part on it. So Land of a Thousand Dances was originally written and recorded by Chris Kenner, a New Orleans R&B singer in 1963.
Okay.
Then another artist called Cannibal and the Headhunters, they added the na-na-na-na-na, the na-na-na-na-na hook.
And a little Chianti and fava beans with that.
Yes. And so finally, you know, Wilson Pickett here, you know, put it together, you know, and really made it a hit.
Now, it should be mentioned that if you're finding this album on streaming, it's way longer than the 12 original tracks that we're covering.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is totally listenable as well. There's very good soul songs. But we're focused on the original 12 tracks. So just wanted to make that clear.
And so you can, if you, again, if you want to find the original album, it appears on, it's on The Exciting Wilson Pickett from 1966. So they're really good at naming his albums.
But yeah, it's a perfect closer for the compilation. It feels like a sweaty finale of like a soul review. Like if you're at a concert that just went, you know, had been going all night, and then for it to finish out this way would be a good way to finish.
All right, well, this is a good time to rewind and reflect on This Is Soul. I'll start with my clickbait headline. This is soul indeed.
Wow. Yeah, but you missed your exclamation point.
Oh, right. Yes. This is soul. Wait, no. This is soul indeed.
I don't make it soulful like a Wilson Pickett would do it or something.
Yeah, I don't have the soul.
No.
It serves its purpose, right? I mean, apparently so many of these soul artists lived on these two record labels. Yeah. So, I mean, when you count the hits here, I mean, you throw the Sam and Dave track on there and the Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's just a great representation of late 60s soul.
Yeah, I mean, it was done for commercial purposes, but that's okay if it opened up some ears to a sound that people in the other parts of the world had never heard.
Right, and Andy's not here, so it's okay.
That's right. Man, we're going to hear about this, I have a feeling. I'll share my clickbait headline to describe my overall vibe of the album. Before Spotify and playlists, This Is Soul was a one vinyl, one-way ticket to soul heaven.
Mm.
Cohesive, despite multiple artists. I think because of that shared production style, that shared band, that shared songwriting pedigrees there, I think it helps to make this not feel like things don't belong together.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, before there were mixtapes, before there were playlists, which now is all a label would have to do is throw together a playlist on Spotify and do this.
But Soul at the time, Essentials.
Yeah. So what were your thoughts on Killer to Filler? I mean, obviously it should be killer.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of big hits on here. When a Man Loves a Woman, Mustang Sally, Land of a Thousand Dances. You got Knock on Wood by Eddie Floyd.
That was kind of disco's ancestor, like the thunderclap snares. And
that's true.
Something disco-y about it.
I got to say, another artist that really pops, just like Aretha, is Otis Redding. You know, yeah. I think maybe his star hadn't completely risen yet, so he doesn't get two tracks, but I mean, he's just another one. I think he and Aretha just really pop on this record.
Well, he had the fa 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 fa, not to be confused with the na 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 na.
Yeah, interesting.
I thought that the Benny King, What Is Soul, song really stuck out like as a manifesto track, kind of the definition by feeling of what soul is.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I mean, Benny King was in the Drifters, and I think his most famous solo record is probably Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And gosh, the way he sings on this is not like he sings on Stand By Me. This is really aggressive.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there's another song on there, Sweet Soul Music, that is kind of also about soul music, and it name drops everybody, pretty much everybody that's on this compilation.
The name drops. Very important. Right.
Very important in hip hop later.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. I wonder how much thought really went into crafting the track list. Like if they just picked like the most obvious song from each artist, right, or if they, you know, were trying
whatever the most recent single was going
to
be.
Probably. Yeah. I'm not really sure. It's hard to find a lot of, you know, stuff written about this compilation. Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us into a production discussion. Choices like that as part of the production here. This is a little different, again, Don, because of the Muscle Shoals connections. They probably were sharing producers. How did they do this?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you've got some, you know, big names in here, Jerry Wexler, Tom Dowd, I guess Stax has a team there. But yeah, so some of these were recorded, you know, at Muscle Shoals. Some of them were recorded in Memphis, you know, with like the Wexler crew.
Mm.
I mean, they were all recorded independently, yes, right? You know, for different albums, but they do all have a lot in common.
Yeah.
You've got that, just a little bit of reverb on the vocal that kind of makes it feel like a church or something. Or,
yeah.
Kind of throws back to gospel, I think.
I agree. The vocals are recorded a little hot, I think.
Yes.
Almost where it's frazzled slightly and it's over the mix. I think it's to emphasize the intensity, you know, putting the soulful performative intensity comes through in the production in that way. And I think that's across the board on all of these. I think it was probably the Atlantic/Stax soul sound that they were looking to proliferate throughout these.
Yeah. I to some extent, I think the stuff is influenced by the earlier Motown sound, you know, but it's a little bit, you know, Motown's just a little bit different.
Cleaner. It's cleaner. Yeah. I think Motown was made to have a broader appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, is more in service of the true soul gospel sound.
Yeah, that's true. It definitely feels more like authentically Southern.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, replay value. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're album nerds. So, I mean, I think we tend to gravitate to albums that are by a single artist.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think this has value. You know, I might listen again.
Yeah. I mean, I might give a try at some of the albums these songs came from. But I have a feeling that this might be a case where, just like if you made yourself a playlist of your favorite soul songs, this might be a little easier to swallow.
And right.
That, you know. But legacy-wise, it's again, this is tough when it comes to compilations because impact, what's the impact, you know?
Yeah, I mean, from what I read, it was commercially impactful in the British market.
Okay.
So, I mean, we can count on that. But the compilation, it is a good snapshot of soul music of that time. It is pretty remarkable that it's all just from two record labels because, I mean, you have legends on here.
Indeed. Yeah, I agree. It helped define soul for UK European audiences in 68. And, you know, if it helped spread the word and spread the music and whether or not it was about making money, so be it. If some of these records made their way into people's collections in other parts of the world, right on.
Yeah. All right. Well, This Is Soul stands as an important anthology offering a definitive snapshot of the genre at its creative peak. It's worth checking out. I mean it.
Anybody want a peanut?
Yeah!
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So a lot of these compilations, they're basically collections of treasures, right? In fact, I feel like there was an album in my parents' collection that was like a holiday treasures.
Yeah, that were very liberally in especially Christmas songs.
Yeah. So it's collecting treasures. What other treasures do you collect?
Collected rocks for a couple of days.
Like, did you know what they were called? Like, what elements they were and stuff?
No, that was one of those things where, like, I think at school we learned about rock collecting. Like, so I glued a bunch of rocks to a piece of cardboard and wrote things under them, and a week later it was
this
in the garden.
This is asphalt.
Yeah. But of course, I mean, I've talked about my vinyl and CD collection. So those are things I've been collecting for 30 years or so. God, that's disgusting. But how about you?
I mean, growing up, I had baseball cards and stuff like that. And then, as you know, at some point, I realized, gosh, all this stuff takes up space. I just don't have room for things. But recently, I've started acquiring Atari games, you know, like the Atari 2600. And I don't want to buy a lot of them. I think I just want to buy ones that I might occasionally play. I guess I like them because I like the limitations of them, right? So a game like Centipede, right? They had to figure out how can we make Centipede still playable with all these, you know, additional limitations on it, you know? So they have to make decisions about what to do. And, you know, I kind of like the results.
They're just an endless loop.
That's true.
Where it just gets faster and faster, and there's really no measurable accomplishments.
That's true. Yeah, it's just you're counting your score, which you have to write down because it doesn't save your high scores.
Yeah.
The artwork was always cool too on the boxes, and always way better than what was inside.
So are you trying to collect like the cardboard box with the cartridge in it, the whole shebang?
If they're available. I mean, I don't care much about the condition, but yeah, I kind of want the, you know, the whole thing. Some of them had like comic strips in them too. Like Centipede has a whole narrative.
Yeah. Sure. That's fascinating.
I think there's going to be a feature film.
Right. About why not?
Well, there was Human Centipede, but that was something else.
Oh, God. You're disgusting.
All right. Well, what do you collect? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
So I went to a familiar well. We've talked about Kiss, actually, just this summer with their Kiss Alive album. This is called Kiss My Ass, Classic Kiss Regrooved from 1994. It was celebrating Kiss's 20th anniversary, which was now 30 years ago.
Amazing. And these songs seemed like classic or old at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So Gene Simmons, the demon bass player of Kiss, helped curate this tribute album. It was aimed to prove that Kiss songs could transcend genres, gain credibility of that grunge alt rock of the 90s.
I think it's a rare occasion where like the artist itself is saying, hey, pay tribute to us. I feel like usually it's somebody, you let somebody else, you know, say, hey, let's pay tribute to the Beatles or whatever. But, you know, we know Kiss is a well-oiled economic machine.
I guess this is, I could get into it right now, but when you have the CD, which I do, I bought it at the time, when you open it, the first thing you see is an ad for a limited number personally signed Kistery book.
Ooh.
For $150 plus $9 shipping. And they have the address, and this offer is for limited time only. So yeah. They're selling stuff for sure.
I think it helps the album as a whole, and you know, like we'll get to it, but I think the fact that Kiss was involved, you know, made it a stronger album.
So the recording of this was decentralized. Participating artists independently produced and recorded their tracks between 1992 and 1993 in various studios. So that's, I think, the draw here is that these are very different sounding. Some of them are true reinterpretations of Kiss songs. And for someone like me that had grown up loving Kiss, not really being a fan, I was a little kid who knew big kids liked Kiss, and I liked it and thought it was cool, but I had never really heard the albums. I didn't have the albums. My parents wouldn't allow it, and there was no streaming service. Mm-hmm. So, when this came out, this was kind of a way for me to get to know some of the songs I maybe hadn't heard or only heard once or twice. Why don't we jump in with the opening track? It's Lenny Kravitz featuring Stevie Wonder with their interpretation of Deuce. So Stevie Wonder is on the harmonica there. Lenny Kravitz is on the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, which there are a million of, which has kind of become his signature. But it's cool. It's a funky reinterpretation of a song that, you know, was riff-driven, swaggering from Kiss, recorded for the album, the debut album from 1974. It was anthemic and primal, and this version makes it feel a little bit different. And I think we discussed the song Deuce when we talked about Kiss Alive. What were your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I was happy that, you know, the album began with a song that I knew pretty well because, like, as you just said, we had discussed it, you know, a few months ago. But yeah, I mean, I love the harmonica on there. Uh-huh. And I would, I think, even if I didn't know it was Stevie Wonder. But yeah, it's a cool treatment of the song, kind of takes away a little bit of the, like, the hard rock element, but it still rocks, though, you know, and there's a little bit of funk. I'm not the biggest Lenny Kravitz fan in the world, but this one works for me. I guess when I'm presented with a cover, I guess I want it to be sort of half, you know, the original and half the new artist's interpretation of it. And so I think this strikes that balance.
I think part of what they're trying to accomplish on this album was giving Kiss songs legitimacy, because when you look at them and you listen to those old records, they're a little shallow. They're a little one-dimensional. And I think all the artists that are featured on this grew up with Kiss. Mm-hmm. These artists are all a little older than us. So I think it was probably a lot of fun for them to pay tribute to musical heroes to some degree, but I think it was to give a legitimacy to these songs for a new generation like us to listen to, because we were aware of Kiss, but probably too young to really be into them.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like maybe the public perception of Kiss kind of changed in this era. I think maybe going into grunge or something, people started to kind of dismiss Kiss as being sort of silly or overly commercial or something.
I think that was more in the 80s, in that in-between time, because by this point we had Pearl Jams and these guys all saying, I learned to play guitar by listening to Kiss albums.
Right.
That's when they started to regain legitimacy.
Yeah.
I think.
I think you're right.
In your face. Let's keep things moving with a true reinterpretation, kind of a hodgepodge of sounds, and kind of making fun of Kiss a little bit, I think. This one's called Calling Dr. Love, performed by Shandy's Addiction. So the original was from Kiss's Rock and Roll Over album from 1976, kind of a sleazy, swaggering Gene Simmons song about being good at sex, pretty much, Dr. Love. Doctors used quite a bit throughout rock and roll history.
Doctor.
Yeah, Mr. MD.
Da-da-da-da-da-da, feel good.
Doctor, feel good, that's right. But the tone of this, the original one, was kind of lighthearted, almost cartoonish. Fitting Kiss's larger-than-life glam, whatever, kabuki image that they had. But Shandy's Addiction was put together, apparently, by the label who was helping select artists for the covers. And they formed this alt-metal supergroup, which included Maynard James Keenan, Tool, or not a Tool, from Tool on vocals, Tom Morello and Brad Wilk from Rage Against the Machine, and then Billy Gould of Faith No More on bass. But the band twisted this song into a dark experimental funk metal, dissonant, feedback-filled, chunky song that is unrecognizable except for the chorus.
Yeah. You know, the first time I listened through this, I wasn't looking at the track list. I'm like, oh, who is this? Who are these guys? And then, you know, I look and I'm like, oh, Shandy's Addiction. I haven't heard of them. They sound pretty good. I wonder what else they did.
This is it.
Yeah. It's a really cool version of the song. I mean, very, it feels of the 90s.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the guitar, I mean, I assume that's Morello on the guitar. It's really good stuff. Mm-hmm.
The name Shandy's Addiction is referencing the Kiss, the soft rock song, Shandy.
Oh.
I think it was from the 1980 album Unmasked, which they didn't actually take their makeup off for. I don't know why it was called that, but Shandy's a really syrupy song, so I think they were kind of poking a little fun there. Yeah, so Don, listening to this, anything stick out to you that made Kiss maybe more interesting to people who are not Kiss fans?
Well, I mean, this one is definitely an interesting cover, right? Definitely a reimagination of the original. Here's Rock and Roll All Night.
This was one I remember before I heard it being like, no thanks, because, you know, walk on the ocean, and like Toad the Wet Sprocket, what are they doing here?
Yeah, so for those of you that weren't alive, this is Toad the Wet Sprocket, a band from California that had, you know, a pretty good moment at this time, but, you know, kind of mellow rock. And yeah, I mean, this is not the spirit of Rock and Roll All Night and Partying Every Day.
Feels like the Hangover song, maybe.
Yeah, or it's like the end of the night. Yeah. It's just you and your buddies playing guitar or something. And I don't know. It's at first, I'm like, well, this doesn't make any sense, you know, because it's just too mellow for the words. But I don't know. Then I sort of, it kind of, I'm like, huh, there is something about it, you know. I mean, there's a lot of country songs that are about tearing it up that are mellow.
I like just the, you drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy. It's like, and then you keep on shouting, you keep on, like the harmonizations and stuff. I
like the
I fell in love with it. Yeah. Because there is something very corny about the original version's Rock and Roll All Night. I mean, it's just so 70s party swagger, and this kind of takes the air out of it, and I like that.
Yeah. Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket said, we decided we'd turn it into a waltz and do like a really silly campfire version of it. So that is basically what it is. And apparently Gene Simmons loved it. He said it was the bravest thing they could have done. Yeah. Do you ever spend time with Toad the Wet Sprocket? I never listened to an album. I wonder.
I haven't. It was on that line between alternative and adult contemporary.
Yeah.
Like with the 10,000 Maniacs and stuff, and I never, it wasn't aggressive enough for me at the time. But yeah, I probably should go check out some of their records because they sound good, pleasant. Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Speaking of pleasant.
Yeah, I'll take that. Speaking of pleasant, let's get into the final track. It's such a weird choice. It's orchestral. It's Black Diamond performed by Yoshiki. Maybe this inspired all those metal bands to do orchestral albums.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, did this pave the way for Apocalyptica? What was it?
Apocalyptica?
Yeah, or Apocalypta, whatever it was.
I don't know.
They were doing all the Metallica covers and stuff before S&M.
So the original Kiss song was on the self-titled from 1974. And theirs is, like, this is unrecognizable. I can't even find the threads of the song. But theirs was a gothic piece with dynamic shifts, acoustic, and then bursts into heavy riffing. And it was kind of ambitious for them. But the Yoshiki cover, I guess Yoshiki performs, like, solo, piano-driven, classically infected music. And this strips the song to piano drama, long crescendos, romantic phrasing. And it's no longer rock. It's just classical theater.
It's very cinematic.
Yeah.
I could picture Kiss like coming out to this, like at a concert or something.
Yes. And I believe this is a Japanese artist. So, yeah, kind of a worldly interpretation. And Gene apparently loved this one as well. And it almost didn't make it. It was only going to be on the Japanese version, but then they changed their minds.
But yeah, I mean, I like the inclusion of this track because, again, I think it accomplishes the mission, which is to legitimize their songwriting, I think. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, this sounds good. You know, it's a nice composition, I think, that can work in a lot of ways.
All right. Well, I think it's about time we rewind and reflect on this compilation as a whole. You know, my overall vibe can be summed up in a clickbait headline. Kiss gets a makeover. Kiss My Ass highlights the band's musical influence. Eclectic and uneven, but sometimes exciting. The thrill is really hearing Kiss through widely different musical lenses, especially since the bands that grew up on Kiss are the ones reinterpreting these. And that, you know, that makes this worth listening to, even as an album experience. I don't think the songs were picked because of their meanings tying together or that they're thematically the same. I think it was for the most interesting mix of artists and interpretations.
All right. Well, I'll give you my clickbait headline. Going really easy today. Yeah. I do want to rock and roll all night.
You sound like it.
And party every day. Kind of in the Toad the Wet Sprocket way.
Right. I want to. Yes.
But yeah, I am I'm slowly becoming a member of the Kiss Army.
Wow. Here, are you like a private or
I might be in like
in the ROTC and ROTC of Kiss.
I think this is a good demonstration that there is kind of more to the songs than maybe we gave them credit for. And you know, I think, you know, some music snobs could kind of dismiss Kiss as being just about the visual aspect or the presentation. But no, I mean, no matter what it is, you have to have good songs. And I think the reason young boys in the 70s fell in love with Kiss was because, you know, the songs, you could sing along with them. And when you see the list of artists here, I mean, these guys wouldn't be participating if they didn't respect the work. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely helps legitimize Kiss in my eyes.
And this brings us to the killer filler ratio, really. We can get through some of the other songs like She, Anthrax was the artist there. They added some thrash power.
Yeah.
It was during the John Bush era as the vocalist.
Oh.
He had a more grungy vocal than Joey Belladonna, who's back with them now, who has that higher registered 80s metal sound.
Ah, that makes sense. I didn't, because I thought they sounded a little different, but
yeah.
Ah, okay.
Another killer, I think, was Lemonheads doing Plaster Caster. It's such a stupid song about, there's apparently a groupie that was famous for getting casts of rock stars' penises, which is, the song's about her, and the fact that she existed at all of her own accord is weird and amazing, I guess. You have any that popped for you?
We might disagree on this one, but I liked the Mighty Mighty Boston's version of Detroit Rock City.
I'm not a Boston's fan, but I wish it had been more Boston's and less Kiss.
It gets, as the song goes on, it becomes more Boston's. You get more horns and stuff. It gets maybe a little skanky.
Yeah, it does get skanky.
Yeah. But I like that. I like, I was happy to see Dinosaur Jr. because I kind of forget about them.
I love how dark Going Blind sounds with Jay Maskus vocal, that droney vocal. It's perfect.
Yeah. And then we've talked about it before, but the Garth Brooks Hard Luck Woman is fantastic. And I mean, if I were Garth Brooks, I would include it in my live shows. And so I feel like I like it better than whatever album we listen to of his. I think this would be a standout cut on that album.
The backing band was Kiss on that one.
Oh, well.
Some of the fillers, like I love the band Extreme, the More Than Words guys, as many might know them. They did Strutter. It's technically very tight, but it sounds very much like the Kiss version with some funky stuff. And I think they did throw in a bit of, what other song they throw in there?
Shout It Out Loud.
Yeah. But it wasn't amazing, you know? And they were kind of, at that point, they were sort of fading.
Yeah, maybe they should have done like a More Than Words treatment.
Christine 16 by the Gin Blossoms. The song is just so cringy because it's about like the 16-year-old girl that I gotta have her. It's just, I 30 years ago, I guess they could still, run with that, but it just sounds yucky to me as an old man.
And I mean, I think the Gin Blossoms do a fine version of it, but it's, I agree. It's not a great song.
I just wanted to quickly mention some of the other bands that had tried to contribute, and for various reasons, record label politics and all that stuff, didn't make it. Reportedly, over 80 artists showed serious interest, but the Smashing Pumpkins, Stone Temple Pilots, Cypress Hill, Nine Inch Nails, Soundgarden, the Melvins, and many more. A lot of other hip-hop artists and things were potentially in the mix, but this is what we got.
Yeah. It would have been fun if they could have gotten a hip hop artist on here.
Yeah. I think Cypress Hill would have nailed it.
Oh yeah.
The production, again, these were all done in separate sessions, so the production is specific to the song. I mean, it's all got a 90s polished sound, so it does sound somewhat cohesive.
Yeah.
But the creativity kind of trumps production there.
Yeah, when I listen to it, I feel like I'm listening to an album and not just a collection of songs. So it works in that way. So I imagine somebody had to kind of master it together or whatever. So it works.
Replayable. I mean, I've listened to this since I got it. I mean, not all the time, but I mean, there's highs and lows, and it's fun and captivating, nostalgic, but it's worth repeated spins. I guess it depends on what you're looking for. If you love one of these artists or some of these artists, it's great to hear. If you're a big Kiss fan, it might be interesting to hear if you haven't before. But it really, I think this is a selective replayability. Again, because it's a compilation, it just hits differently.
And I mean, I'm not a huge fan of cover albums. Like, I think they're cool. You listen to them once or twice and you say, oh, that's a good version, that's not. And then you kind of move on with your life. I find it to be a good album to listen to from beginning to end. So yeah, I'll probably check it out again. And I guess as I'm learning the Kiss catalog, this is a helpful guide.
Sure. The legacy of this, I mean, this was their legacy at 20, their 20 years legacy. Now it's been 50. So at that time, this was a definitive statement of Kiss's influence across genres and validated their songwriting beyond their image. And it shows the 1990s alternative metal country artists had reverence for this band. And I think that was part of what they were trying to accomplish here. And they did. 30 years later, because many of these are probably to the kids today, irrelevant bands or things they haven't heard of. I don't know.
I don't know. There was some resurgence that kind of happened somewhere, where it happened, I'm not sure. But in the 90s, I think Kiss kind of came back in the public consciousness. And I think this is probably an important part of it, because I think they needed the rest of the music industry to say, hey, these guys are good and these guys are influential. And, you know, they're the reasons, you know, we make music today. But yeah, overall, I think it's probably a piece in sort of, you know, forming the Kiss legacy.
Yeah. So Kiss My Ass is asterisks on the album cover in some areas. A wild ride through Kiss's legacy, proving their influence spans genres and generations. Mostly killer with a little filler, but I still think it's worth checking out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. Well, we've been digging for treasure all week. That sounds bad.
Yeah. Sounds weird. I don't know why it shouldn't. I mean, if we were pirates, it'd be cool.
Yes. Well, did you have a chance to dig anything else this week?
So the soul vibe continued for me. So I thought it'd be appropriate to talk about a funky R&B soulful album. This one is by Curtis Harding. It's called Departures and Arrivals, Adventures of Captain Kurt. Just came out in September 2025. He's an Atlanta-based singer-songwriter, blending soul, funk, R&B. This is, I believe, is his fourth album, recorded live with his band. It's a space opera concept about a pilot lost in space reflecting his feelings of displacement. Let's listen to a little bit of the opening track, There She Goes. When she's happy, everybody knows. So it's 11 tracks, 42 minutes, featuring that song, True Love Can't Be Blind, Time. Scored a 78 on Metacritic, which is pretty good. Ambitious, emotional, cinematic. Very cool. I'm going to be digging deeper into this one as the weeks go by.
There's got to be some Bowie references in there, right? Like for Major Tom or something. You know,
I've only listened like three times. I haven't, you know, gotten to that part of my relationship with the album.
The all too critical.
The Bowie phase. So then, of course, I was inspired by the Kiss of like kind of what came next of the sort of glam metal thing is what came after Kiss and probably existed because of Kiss, at least in part, and was more the stuff I was growing up on in elementary school was this artist Rat with two T's. The album is Out of the Cellar. They became one of the leading bands of that Sunset Strip scene and helped popularize glam metal during the era. Let's listen to a little bit of the big one for them, Round and Round. Out of the Cellar was released on March 27, 1984, their debut studio album. Immediate success, MTV play. Out of the Cellar combines the hard rock elements of Van Halen, Aerosmith, and then those glam metal aesthetics. And it's become kind of a classic, and I'm glad to have it now in my vinyl collection. I just acquired it a few weeks ago. It's in good shape, and it's a fun listen.
Nice. Yeah, this was the early run of glam metal kind of taking over MTV.
Yeah. Yep. What you been digging, buddy boy?
Well, I saw that the band Cut Copy, which is an Australian band, they back in like 2008 or so, they, you know, were kind of on the indie scene, kind of synth poppy. They have a new album called Moments. Here's a song called Still See Love.
I still see love in your heart.
Yep. That tracks.
It's got like that euphoric dance vibe to it.
Yeah, but also that I'm all alone.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so these guys are speaking my language.
No one wants to dance with me. Oh, crikey. Yeah, you got to rhyme crikey with dance with me.
Nice. All right. Well, let's we'll change gears a little bit here. Anne Murray.
See, I wish I had like a brake squealing, crashing cars sound effect right now.
Yeah. You're probably familiar with Anne Murray.
Of course. Canadian treasure.
Yep. A Canadian pop singer, kind of country, adult contemporary. Been around a long time, you know, lots of hits, you know, particularly like in the 70s and 80s, I think. So she has a new album. It's all stuff, I guess, that was recorded between the years 78 and 96. Okay. But this popped up on, you know, some recommendation here, probably because I had been listening to Bryan Adams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here's her cover of Straight from the Heart.
Oh, boy.
From
sounds more hopeful and less forlorn.
Yes.
Than Brian's version.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought it was, you know, kind of fun.
Yeah, that's fun.
I like some of these Square artists. You know,
yeah. Yeah. I like Kenny Rogers and stuff. It's like cool. It's cool, uncool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here we are again. It's about time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Gene Simmons of Kiss. Is this going to cost us anything? Do we have to pay royalties? Probably. And I quote, "I've always said, when you're good at something, never do it for free."
That's why the Album Nerds is free.
Yes. Because we suck. With that in mind, let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to see what kind of albums we'll be discovering next time.
Next time, we're exploring literary albums, records shaped by the written word. From novels and poetry to myth and storytelling, these works draw inspiration from literature, turning pages into lyrics and transforming timeless tales into music.
Well, 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 Professor, you should be right in your element. You are a collegiate treasure, so it's your time to shine with literary themes in right. albums.
But I am not a professor of literature. We'll just make that clear.
Wow, you blew it. You could have really played this whole thing up as the expert.
I think I'll get a pipe though or something.
Okay,
a nice cardigan sweater.
Excellent.
The jacket with the patches on the elbows.
Perfect. You don't already have those, isn't that Professor 101? Jeez.
All right, what's your favorite album with literary themes? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 307 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. We will catch you next time when we have our very own private book club.
When a man loves an album, he'll spend his very last dime.
That's true, I've done it.
Buying import sleeves and box sets.
Preach. Yes.
Channeling Percy.
Oh, God. All right, we'll see you next time.